Hello, friends. This is Dan Platt, of the host of this program. For reasons that I'm unaware of, the audio recording stopped abruptly for this episode, right after I said I have a theory about the article I was reading. I'm not sure exactly what the thought was, but I'm sure it'll come back to me at a future date, or I'll come around to the point I was going to make. Otherwise, I was very close to finishing up the article and the show. Thus, I will start this program with the housekeeping I would end with by reminding you that the best way to grow the show and spread it to other people is, of course, word of mouth. I have a Patreon, though, if you'd like to support materially to expedite some outreach. Otherwise, social media at Twitter and Facebook, The Three Left Show, as well as the website, threelefts.news, where you can find the show notes and links for every episode once it is posted. Not only is it those posted at those places, but also on any app that you may have.
And I'm not a really good American because I like to form my own opinions.
Huh? What?
There's tons of examples of corporate greed, inequality, and disregard for the environment that make people wonder if markets are evil. And they are.
Maybe Lise is right about America being the land of opportunity, and maybe Adil has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
Where it's like, hey, wake up, liberals. You can't always do, sometimes you gotta, but that's actual quote from Karl Marx.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
If I were to ever start a country with a communist government, wink, wink, wait 12 years.
Men are seduced by communists, women so much so that they deem communism nice. Communists murdered mostly the Nazis.
Bottom-up horizontal connection, sharing at all levels, is key.
Describing is anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
I mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group.
I believe so, sure.
What kind of garbage is that? Oops, my anarchy symbol.
So just so you're not going crazy, you're listening to WCAALP, The Voice, community radio station here at Grand Street Community Arts. I'm Dan Platt. This is The Three Left Show. This program covers news, issues, thoughts, and activism, anything of interest from a radical left perspective. For the curious or the committed, promoting a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy. We're going in a different direction. And I definitely come at things from a different direction. Always so many thoughts. I'm always reading new things and like, oh, I could talk about this. I could talk about that. Meanwhile, I have a stream of news stories that my Facebook feed gives. Maybe I'll take in August, I'll take a hiatus from that. I have enough content for today's show and next week's show. All filled up, at least with things to discuss, things I found, things that aren't talked about enough. And but then something was brought up that kind of like, yeah, I need to think about that too, which is, you know, if you're riding a bike or driving a car, you know, if you're looking at the ground, that's where you gotta end up. If you wanna move forward, you need to be looking at where you wanna go. So I need to be talking more about, and I have. I have plenty of episodes about it, so it's not like I've been neglectful of this stuff. But talking about post-capitalism, talking about, you know, socialist future, imagining it, and also just the policy, and I'll be doing a little bit of that. I'll open the show with that before going into the whys of the present, because another strand that, you know, I want to accomplish with this program overall is, in order to be mature citizens and mature people overall, we need to have a certain understanding of the world we live in. So, for example, on a personal level, if we want to deal with some of the personal issues we may have or see in others, one of the prerequisites that I've, you know, come to understand is that an understanding of the power dynamics between people is probably the first step in letting go of certain expectations and images, which lead to toxic/a-hole behavior. Whatever form that takes. Could take the form of addiction. It could take the form of just being mad all the time. It could take the form of cynicism, in that you may have found the truth out. You know, you're not deluded by some myth or authority, but the emotions wrapped up in believing in that image are still there. You haven't really let go. So instead of feeling empowered by knowing the truth, let's say knowing that there is a crisis that we're in, that the world is in crisis environmentally, economically, and socially, it just becomes a big disappointment. I don't know if it has its own name yet, but there's this kind of the caricature. Instead of a nihilist misanthrope that hates humanity, hates the world, and feels very hopeless all the time, there's kind of the bloomer, someone who has hope, someone who can see where we can go to get out of this, to have a future. And I could count myself among one of them. That's why I'm doing this program. I am not moping in my room all day. But there's different kinds of feedback loops. There's the cynical feedback loop. There's the negative one, the one that encourages us to split our minds in half between a good self and a bad self, instead of being a whole person. And then there's the type that is like a positive feedback loop, where we trust ourselves, which in turn allows us to actually trust other people. Or, at the very least, that let's say we are wronged again, disappointed, let down, whatever, it is something we can overcome, deal with at the time, as well as not affect us as greatly. Yeah. So let's go into the topics. So I have a story from the People's World, which is a continuation of the Daily Worker, which is, you know, one of those old socialist racks, which originally founded in 1924. And People's World, I guess, is the next or current alliteration of it. But the story is a short one, simple one. It's titled, Native American Communist Topples Incumbent Council President in Wisconsin Town. So this is just a simple local race in which a radical leftist won, which is probably where we can win if we put our minds to it, as well as collect some help. This was published May 7th of this year. This is in Ashland, Wisconsin. The Democratic Party primaries have been heating up across the nation over the last year. Progressive Dems like Representative Cortez of New York and an array of other primary presidential candidates all pushing for their progressive causes. Local elections have also taken place that deserve special note. One of the more interesting of these happened last month in Ashland, where a Native American, Wahasha Whitebird, who is also a member of the Communist Party USA, defeated the city council president David Metville in a nonpartisan contest. So things to note about radical leftists winning local office, they're usually nonpartisan contests. So there's usually not a party name attached to it, or ballot access needs. Simply it's a very short, simple petition, which isn't thousands of signatures, but usually a few dozen. Next, I'll point out that the Communist Party USA is very... it's almost center left. They endorse Democrats usually. Like they're even to the to the right of DSA. They don't actually push for anything real, and they've basically been a frame, like a puppet party almost, like a kind of equality, well, fusion party of sorts, but not really. They don't really have the membership or the funds to really do anything substantial, and they've been that way since, I'll put it at the 70s. Basically when the left was crushed entirely, and basically it was made sort of, if not legal, but for socially forbidden to be a leftist. But let's keep going. This is still kind of local. I mean, so maybe, very least, this is someone who is a self-described socialist, full socialist. Let's see. There's some media attention in bigger cities. In northern Wisconsin now, for the first time, a communist is on the city council in Ashland, who defeated in a vote 52-42. Whitebird, a worker in the town deli, is in an excellent position to engage one-to-one in person with voters in the period leading up to it. A member of the United Food and Commercial Workers, he decided to run for office, he said, after talks with labor and community leaders. Naturally. Not in anyone's wildest imagination was an openly communist Native American challenging the city council president ever expected to win. talking about his opponent, Metile is the name. Whitebird said, I asked him to come and have a town hall debate. He would always respond that he was always too busy. Whitebird ran an old-fashioned working-class political campaign, mostly just doing doors. He had a small but dedicated group of volunteers, always necessary. The main message of his campaign was higher wages, affordable housing, and more homeless shelters. Not exactly a militant indictment of capitalism, many are stereotyped as always putting forward, but he just focused on simple policies. Now in a position to act on his campaign promises, he's introduced an ordinance to increase the minimum wage. His proposal is different from many bills passed in other states, calling for across the board, but gradual $15 minimum wage hikes. Instead, he said his ordinance would depend on the size of the business, 10 for a local, 13 for a national business, 15 for an international. Interesting. Something else he is bringing into the politics of Ashland and into U.S. politics, too, is for-profit industrial agriculture ventures, because likely that's the area he's in. Whitebird is a member of the Bad River Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa. It isn't an uncommon practice for indigenous governments to own and operate for-profit enterprises to provide employment and revenue for their citizens, which is kind of like a communist enterprise, but also not really. It's working in the market. By admitting I'm a communist, I cast a beacon for those who oppose me, but also for those who agree with me. He says, seeing his campaign as an opportunity to build a coalition around working class issues in the city of Ashland. Doesn't say how big Ashland is, but I'm considering the vote total. I put it around 50,000. That's a guess. Let's see. So this is also just kind of a mini lesson in how to do a political campaign. I am available as a political consultant, and I don't really charge. I do time banking, so you can do a time trade with me on Simbi. That's the site, S-I-M-B-I. Okay, again, in the line of local governments doing radical things, or being radical in general, just that it isn't a losing proposition to be actually left, and not just the kind of nominal American left, which, you know, speaks of like women first, lean in, you know, neoliberal stuff. Barcelona orders first expropriation of empty flat owned by a bank. Now, usually when it comes to leftist policy, being communist means expropriating businesses. Businesses that are not working for the people or working towards the common good are expropriated, as in stolen by the state. But remember, a business is allowed to operate with a business license by the state. It is through the state's laws, the state's protection, that the business operates. So, yeah, what the state giveth, it taketh away. That's why there's that libertarian movement. It's like, well, we want to prove that we don't need the state and we can still be capitalist and private enterprise. Well, good luck with that, Joe. Let's go into it. So this is from the Telegraph. I know it's a British newspaper. Okay, by James Badcock. Yes, Badcock. In Madrid of last month. Barcelona's left-wing mayor, Ada Colau, has ordered the expropriation of an empty, that's in quotes, flat owned by a bank, and a first for the city facing a shortage of homes. So for a little context, which I don't think it gives fully here, Barcelona, like many other major cities in the world, is facing a housing crisis. Part of it is through Airbnb, that's it. Airbnb is dominating, and in Barcelona, being the kind of city it is dominated by tourism. So much so that the tourism is choking local life and raising rents, as people are using Airbnb to fill up what should be residential neighborhoods for locals. Now entire swaths of the city are being kind of given over to visitors and tourists, and that's basically not leaving enough housing for locals. Ms. Colau, a former housing campaigner who started her second term as mayor last week, put to use a law passed by the Catalan Parliament in 2016. That's the state that Barcelona is in. It has its own independence movement, which is currently in crisis because they had a referendum, but then the national government kind of blocked it with force. Under its terms, local authorities can claim homes owned by companies that have many properties in their portfolios if they are left vacant for 2 years or more. a lot of stipulations there. It's not willy-nilly. The homes can remain under public control for 4 to 10 years. The law was suspended by Spain's constitutional court after a challenge by the government of former conservative prime minister Mariano Rajoy. But last year, the court ruled it was in order. Quote, this empty flat will now form a part of a municipal housing stock for 10 years, said Lucia Martin, Barcelona's councillor in charge of it, of housing. Ms. Martin added that expropriation orders were being prepared for 7 other properties belonging to banks. You know, in a city as large as Barcelona, that's really slim, but again, this is the first, so they'll ramp up, I'm sure. The council says it discovered the apartment had been empty for 2 years through the residency register and a lack of utility payments. The law can only be applied to properties in areas with a, quote, strong residential demand, as in the Bizarros district, where the flat... Oh, man. You know, I consider myself a worldly gent, but lately, as I've been reading these foreign stories, I'm noticing I am terrible pronouncing things. If I studied more Spanish, I would know how to handle that word. Where the flat belonging to Spain's BBVA bank is located. Having observed a 2-year vacant period, the council must then ask the owner to allow the property to be used as social housing and can only proceed to the expropriation phase in the case of a refusal or no reply. BBVA claims that Barcelona Council has made a mistake, grave mistake, in that it will challenge this expropriation in court. The home has not been empty during the past 2 years, and in fact, it has currently been occupied by a disadvantaged family, says their spokeswoman. Okay. Protecting less wealthy Barcelona residents from the impact of the city's tourism and real estate boom has been a priority for Ms. Colau. Measures taken by her Barcelona Comú party include a memorandum on new hotels and tourism rental apartments and a system of mediation to seek solutions when landlords wish to evict residents. Ms. Martin said on Friday that evictions in Barcelona fell by 23% between 2015 and 2018. Ms. Colau was able to take power thanks to support of the former French Prime Minister Mauro Valls, mayoral candidate who lent his party's council votes to her in order to prevent a separatist candidate securing the seat. Yeah, so that's that nationalist movement I mentioned, where separation is the first priority, and then everything else, whether it be economic policy, whatever, just kind of comes later or second or, but the Catalan area has always been kind of like that, going back to the Spanish Civil War and much further ago. It's kind of its own cultural ethnic group. Long ago in the Middle Ages, it was the Kingdom of Aragon, separate from the Castilian monarchy. And yeah. So expropriation is just one of those tools in a statist toolbox. If it was grassroots, let's say you take an anarchist approach, I guess it would be a matter of squatting. Like, say, the house is empty. Let's say it really is empty. It's not, there's no disadvantaged family and the bank is lying. You take your person, you take your group, you break in, so to speak, or Jimmy the Lock, and then you, squat in it and basically say, no, we're gonna use this as social housing ourselves. No state authorization required. You'll have to force us to leave, and you challenge both the corporation and the state at the same time. So, which is much harder, but can be done, or has been done. At least in Europe, there's a squatty movement, and there is a certain amount of squatter rights. There are small, like there's another story in California where a city was taking zombie properties, you know, that the banks foreclosed on, and they're not reselling them, where they actually expropriated the houses there as well to rehab or just put them back in people's hands with a low interest loan, a reasonable mortgage, which banks do not provide. If they provide mortgages at all, which they don't always do. So next I have a story from MarketWatch. Hopefully this show is also an exercise in critical reading. Critical reading meaning when you read something that you have an internal monologue questioning pretty much everything you read or inserting your own self-experience and knowledge. You know, you trust yourself enough that you're not going to take every word. Don't take everything for granted. But this is a kind of how does capitalism work? How does our economic system work? What are the kind of institutions we have, and do we feel they are legitimate or not? America is said to be a nation of laws, constitution. Everyone seems to have a positive opinion about it. But this is an opinion piece. Apparently, it's marked as opinion. Capitalism's dirty secret. I think it's all dirty, but let's say there's an underlining issue at hand. It was built by lawyers, not by the invisible hand. So a little myth-busting here about the invisible hand of markets. Markets are enforced and built by the law. That's why when we say we're a nation of laws and capitalism, they're one and the same, for the most part, especially when it comes to modern laws. The law, as far as in modern nation state from the Renaissance forward, developed hand-in-hand with capitalism. Lawyers have rigged the system, and that is fueling inequality and the rise of populism. Yeah. So here's a quote. All are equal before the law, and yet law is often deals a better hand to some than to others. Kind of like political speech, legal speech is also something you have to pay for. You can be provided a public attorney, but that is not real justice, nor is it, especially when there is actual, and that's only if you're arrested and deemed to be causing trouble to the state personally. But if you want to seek reparations or in a civil suit, you have to pay for it. There is no public attorney's office for seeking restitutions in the public square. Because you're operating in a public market, and there should be public lawyers to have access to. And that's kind of one of my policies on the local level as far as crime stopping and security, is to resolve disputes and beefs and fights with publicly provided mediators and social workers rather than the police, which can be trained at de-escalation, and that's very helpful and good. But why just them? Why not have social workers do this job? They go into, it's a different field of work, where one is about enforcement of the law, the other is about enforcement of empathy, put that way. So back to the article. This is by Rex Nutting, columnist for Market Watch. If the economy is so good, why are so many people struggling? That's the trillion-dollar question in politics and economics. The persistently widening gap between Wall Street and Main Street gave rise to populists of both right and left. On the right, the response to rising inequality and discontent is to blame outsiders, then get the government out of the way, and rely completely on the magic of the free market to create a just economy. On the left, the reply is to democratize, that is, socialize, the economy by giving the public an effective voice to rewrite the rules on taxes, antitrust, healthcare, housing, education, trade, the environment, employment, and income, so that everyone may benefit from the nation's bounty. Now, that's a democratic socialist, a social democrat take, so it's not really kind of socialist I identify as, because to me, democratizing and socializing means direct control by citizens, guided perhaps by experts, since expertise doesn't matter, but it's a matter of not putting experts in control, it's putting people in control, but experts then provide expertise. Anyway, a new book by Columbia Law School professor Katharina Pister, quote, called The Code of Capital, How the Law Creates Wealth and Inequality, argues that the free market isn't so free. Yeah. Capitalism didn't spring fully formed like Venus emerging from the sea. There is no primal capitalism to which we must return. There is no pure form of capitalism forged by invisible hand. Instead, capitalism we know was painstakingly built by the invisible pens of lawyers, judges, that created over time broader and bolder property rights that are ultimately enforced by the power of the state. With the help of the law and state power, capitalists have tilted the playing field, making sure that their property rights are respected and protected over the rights of everything else. I add that. Pister shows exactly how the system was rigged. In her work, rising inequality is a logical conclusion of a legal order that systematically privileges some holders' assets but not others. Pister says the logical result of such a system is rising inequality and the disenfranchisement of democratic constituents, meaning it makes democracy unworkable. It's not really there. It's just a name. It's just a symbol. An image. An illusion. So instead of getting cynical about that illusion being not really about it being an illusion, it should empower you to say, okay, we need to get money out of politics. Bernie's right. All those other leftists are right. Coercive power of the state. The result is an economy and political system that serves only a few. So, like, what kind of other assets do people have besides capital, you know, money in the bank? And I mean, by money in the bank, I mean, shut up, money. Billions of dollars, millions of dollars, not a few thousand or 10,000. Capital is inextricably linked to law and state power because, in its absence, the legal privileges capital enjoys would not be respected by others. Without the power of the state to enforce rights, the law of the jungle would prevail. But the law of the jungle, what is the law of the jungle? You mean common law, social laws, the laws of supply and demand? People demand food, so they would supply themselves with it. The law of the jungle would prevail in a modern economy with all of its marvelous things it has brought us would be impossible. So, yeah, so this writer is certainly pro-capitalist, it seems. It at least sounds that way from this little quip here. Because he's like, well, our modern lives depend on... Well, yeah, of course, I guess that's a truism. The modern world is a capitalist one, so if we didn't have capitalism, then we wouldn't have a modern world. But that doesn't make it inherently morally good. It certainly has its advantages, but it's also unsustainable. It needs to transform in this crisis we're in. Okay. With the right legal coding, any object, claim, or idea can be transformed into capital. Mm-hmm. Like, intellectual property and all the ways. And it's also called like rent-seeking behavior. Spurred on by their clients, lawyers have pushed the boundaries of what can be considered capital over the centuries. This is a very long process, using techniques updated from feudal times to code land, debt, stocks, bonds, derivatives, ideas, digital code, genetics even, and even our emotions, into capital that can be bought, sold, hoarded, or converted into money. I think that could be what Facebook is trying to do now, but I think it just sounds like, well, I won't get into it. The essence of capital is durable and transferable property rights over assets. The legal coding in deeds, trusts, wills, debts, corporate charters, sales, and user agreements, antitrust law, I guess, bankruptcy laws, patent law, and thousand other documents determine who has the priority claim. In other words, who are the winners and who are the losers? So usually the right usually say the complaint is that the government steps in and decides who's a winner and loser. But this is ignorant or blind to the fact that we already have a system or an entity that steps in and says who's the winner and loser. It's called the law. And so the state's intervention is enforcing the law, enforcing who says he's a winner or loser. So when it's a small-time farmer is in the loser, it's because the law decided so. And the enforcement of the law falls to the state. So you blame the state for what the law is. Right, but it's also a question of who's determining what's the law. The rich. Duh, not you. Political questions decided behind closed doors. These are not abstract concerns. With more than the world's wealth accumulating in fewer hands, with capital expanding its domain to encompass more intangibles, including my thoughts, my movements, my DNA, and even my facial expressions. And by movement, they mean like moving between borders, I assume. If you have enough money, you can hop borders however you like, but if you don't, then you're a criminal. The rights and privileges of capital are urgent matters for all of us. The capital controlled by Facebook, Alphabet, and Amazon consists mostly of trade secrets built on a big database of our behavior. What we search for, what we share, what we buy. Who has the right to benefit from the bounty created by man and earth? Who owns the land? The people who worked it for generations are the colonial interloper with a piece of paper signed by a distant king. Who owns nature? Should nature be owned? Who owns my body, my thoughts, my genes? Who owns the store of human knowledge? Now, it's kind of a libertarian thing or an anarcho-capitalist thing that's like you have self-ownership. You own yourself. A very dangerous paradigm. It has a lot of problems. Best to just consider things not to be ownable or that ownership is always shared. I think it's part of social relations that you, quote-unquote, belong to any group that you're consensually a part of, as much as everyone there belongs to you. It's usually described as belonging. but in that kind of more ethereal, lovey-dovey way. Belonging is not the same as owning. Who wins and who loses when things don't work out as hoped? Who gets bailed out and who doesn't? And most importantly, who decides? These are political questions, but for the most part, they have been decided legally, mostly without the input or even the notice of the public. To say that the market will decide begs the question, for the market can only work if property rights are established. It's the law that's deciding. And who decides the law? Capitalist does. Or capitalist interest. They hire the lawyers then fashion the laws, and everyone in that section of society wins. The rest of us don't. All are equal before the law, Pister writes, and yet law often deals a better hand to some more than others. Kind of like saying, we're all equal, but some are more equal than others. Which is why ideologies like that are autocratic, authoritarian in nature. They don't really... Governance by axiom is not always good. It is not to the strong or the swift or the wise that the victory belongs, but to the one with the best lawyer. That is the source, ultimately, of our economic inequality. It's no surprise that the big banks were able to privatize all the gains and socialize all the losses. They wrote the contracts and the mortgages and created the derivatives. Plus, they were too big to fail. Capital rules, and it rules by law. Pister writes, it owns its capacity to create wealth to the modules of a legal code that is backed by state power, and its resilience in times of crisis can be attributed to a combination of legal asset shielding devices, defensive measures, and the state's willingness to extend a helping hand to capital to preserve not only capitalism, but social stability, and by implication, the state itself. But there is also kind of a stateless capital. Capital gets the protection of the state, but capital itself is stateless, able to roam the globe to find the most favorable legal regime. Well, it's not stateless. There's just a global state. There are global institutions with kind of state powers. Not the kind of state power like it has an army and it's enforcing laws. But by global agreements, then the national states act as the enforcement arm for a global state. You know, the world order. So in that case, I disagree with calling that stateless. As economist Albert Hirschman noted, members of organizations or societies, such as consumers, workers, companies, or citizens, have three options. They can exit, they can voice, or loyalty. If you don't like something, you can raise your voice and try to change things, or you can leave. But where do you go when you're in a global capitalist system? Mars? But under a form of undemocratic capitalism, few have a powerful voice, especially not consumers or workers. And the threat of exit is blocked for most people. As Hirschman, a refugee from the Nazis, well knew, they say love it or leave it, but mere mortals cannot move at will as capital can. People need passports, visas, a country's version of the U.S. green card. So most people are blocked from either having a voice or leaving, which leaves them with only one choice, blind and unquestioned loyalty. So much for freedom. Most of us cannot roam around the globe to seek an economic system that gives us a voice. We are stuck as consumers, as citizens, where we are, and that is the appeal of populism. It promises us to give us our voice back. The populists of the right have misdiagnosed the illness, blaming other states, supernatural organizations such as the EU, and most conveniently natural persons with no or only a foreign passport is hardly a solution when in fact the real winners are hiding in plain sight in their own midst and use the law to fashion their winnings. For democracy to prevail, as it is, the people must regain some control over the law to reset the balance of power in our economy, she says. Most likely it won't be a revolution that does it, but a slow, incremental, whittling away of capital's advantages, exactly the way it was created. I kind of see that. But some of that whittling, like, happens because of revolution. It's a revolution, in fact, that actually jolts things towards a more equitable relationship, just as it took multiple kind of revolutions of various types, violent or otherwise, to whittle away feudalism. I think that's the same as same can be said. But the way they describe it, it makes it sound like it's just kind of parliamentary reformism. That's how we whittle away capital. Okay, then let's try passing something that helps build post-capitalism. good luck with that. Expropriating bank-owned homes and creating municipal stock, that's part of it. But again, it's like so many different stipulations they had to do it under, and how to put it, and of course challenged it every way by the courts, the law. I prefer some kind of policy. I just someone actually at a council meeting that I didn't actually go into, but outside of, he suggested that there be, we just make rent-to-own contracts the norm. Encourage them to be the norm, or I'll have to look at, if, again, you create the law, at least when it comes to progressive law, you just make the law, and then you demand that your opposition basically challenge you. As most people do. That's the thing. Like, when it comes to liberals, they want to make sure that everything's legal before they do anything. The right, or just people with power, just do it. And then you have to sue them and spend millions of dollars challenging them. Why don't we do that? I mean, they have the millions to spend, no doubt, but make them spend it. Don't give in. Capitalism won't be destroyed by this process, just transformed into a system that benefits all instead of a few. I don't see how that works. I mean, feudalism transformed into capitalism, it certainly increased the number of beneficiaries, but it did not create a just society. More just for a few more people, but, well, again, I don't disagree with what's being said here. Yes, the transformation will be gradual, but how does that gradual change happen? And when's real gradual change instead of kind of a marginal, like, for example, let's say when Nancy Pelosi suggests a reform, that is a incremental change that just reinforces or continues the inequality and the injustice we have. It does not do anything to counter it. There are reforms that can and do. And those are just called non-reformist reforms. But I don't really have any other phrase to describe something that I wouldn't consider to be just going around in circles, reforms, like reforms that corruption just catches up with in 5 years' time, and then basically it's like your reform didn't matter. And that's what a lot of the Obama-era reforms amounted to. 5-6 years later, they're gutted, tattered up, whatever. Oh, yeah, and the last line, and this is where I'm just, maybe we could... So this capitalism won't be destroyed by this process of incremental change, but transformed into a system that benefits all instead of a few. Maybe we could call it democratic capitalism. But isn't the whole point of this discussion in this article that capitalism is undemocratic? But that's where that paragraph that I also disputed about, how like, look, you just have a set of laws that, let's go back to it, because this is a valuable, yes, on the left, the reply is to democratize the economy by giving the public an effective voice to rewrite the rules. So, capitalism can be democratic, says the center-left person. And this goes for even Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren here. That's why when I say on the left, I'm not actually talking about them. I mean, I'll mention them positively. I'm not a hater. But there is a friendly disagreement that it isn't just the changing of the laws. Because the laws were created. It's an institution that reinforces power. So the argument, as you may have surmised, maybe, is that we can fashion laws that democratize the voice, the ability to change the law. So instead of it just being in the hands of those with money to hire the lawyers, so either you give everybody the money, and by the way, I'm being kind of coy here, give everyone a bit of money to hire their own lawyer, you organize, like unions have lawyers, and then you can fight on an even playing field, so to speak. They still lost in the end, so really wasn't even. And that's kind of where my revolutionary rhetoric comes in of, look, you can match the corporations lawyer for lawyer, but in the end, the law is going to is inherently on their side. And that goes for regulations too. You can have as many regulations and rules that hem and of course, you know, businesses and capitalists hem and haw about. But in the end, they still have all the power. Because those, whatever regulations you put on needed massive social upheaval to do in the first place. And that is not something that I would rather not be the norm. So what exactly is being proposed? And the fact that I don't think any of these writers or opinion makers can really describe and articulate, like, how do we have this democratic, how do you make capitalism democratic? And because they're also, they have their blind spots about, it isn't just the law, but it is part of it, and certainly undergirding it, that capitalism cannot be democratic. That this market, body of social relations. And that's where you get not hard Marxism, that it doesn't really matter what the law is, what matters is the social relations. So unless you're transforming the social relations, brought up like the questions, those political questions of who owns what, can you own nature? That wasn't one of the questions, but who owns nature? But again, that's the wrong question. Why does nature need to be owned? Nature doesn't have an owner, we are part of nature. That's ecological thinking. And that's what's missing from any of these capitalist minds or these center-left thinkers, that they're still acting in a paradigm that says, yeah, we still have ownership of the land. It isn't really common land, all of it, but it's just we got to divide it up. We got to divide up the pie. Yeah, I was reading, by happenstance, the latest Tom Friedman column. I think he's going in a full, I swear, shit poster because he was like, now's not the time for a revolution. We need a nice moderate Democrat who will grow the pie and then split it up. I want a pro-growth Democrat. Like, you're still talking about growth? The world's burning. Like, we can't, there's this delusion. We can grow the economy. We can grow infinitely. Conceit of capitalism. It's by law that you have to keep growing. You have to pay the dividends out first. Then go green. Can't grow and be sustainable. Not infinitely. Okay? But let's go through my housekeeping. A reminder that word of mouth is the best thing to do. Your part in growing the show and a number of like-minded comrades. You can leave a review on the podcast platforms, Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes, the main ones. And share the three lefts via your chosen social media platform. I use Facebook and Twitter. To support the show more materially, visit our Patreon page and become a member there. All money raised goes to tech, support, and outreach. Links for all shows, all for this episode and any others, is posted on the website threelefts.news, where every episode is also archived. Thank you for joining me for this half of the Three Left Show.
One, two, three, four. Well, your race was faster than the inflation rate, then you're gonna have 5 million today. And you'll be only way to compensate is that something's gonna have to give. Something's gonna have to give. Start a revolution. Whoa, yeah.
something's gonna have to give. Start a revolution. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome, welcome to the second half of the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt. This is the leftist reading hour critical thinking extravaganza. We cover leftist points of view, rather just regular issues, but from a radical leftist perspective. From three tendencies, ecology, socialism, and anarchism. Three great tastes, better together, depending on each other, as we all do. So to work off of the last story, which was about how the law is what dominates our society and decides, what really decides, who are the winners and the losers, and who decides what the law is. Now, there's an open, up in there question, a lot of debate of whether or not, like, the question is, like, well, does that mean we have to have a different way of governing society that is not law-based? Or rather, having rules that are more contextual based on communities and regions rather than an across-the-board law. Now, of course, by having states, we solve a little bit of that tension. But obviously not all of it, since states themselves can be very diverse, both in having rural and urban areas, suburbs. And then again, you just keep going on down and saying, well, by having municipal laws. But here in New York, localities are very hamstrung by state law in what they can do. Why? Well, you don't want to basically have localities threaten business interests by passing all kinds of crazy socialist laws. Or, on the flip side, a bunch of very right-wing laws. To give an example of it, on how markets, as they're set up, do not provide democratic or any kind of choice or freedom. Here is, and I covered, and this is also the build off of the live episode I did last week, that would be episode 55, where I talked about transportation issues and cars. So here is from The Atlantic. I don't always like The Atlantic, but here is an ideas column. Americans shouldn't have to drive, but the law insists on it. The automobile took over because the legal system helped squeeze out the alternatives. By Gregory Schill, a law professor. Now, in the last week's episode, I, in fact, did mention that one of my radicalizing moments was something akin to reading something like this, but doing a research paper exploring it. So I read a book, a whole book. This article will likely summarize. So, you're welcome. You don't have to do as much work as I did. In a country where the laws compel the use of cars, Americans are condemned to lose friends and relatives to traffic violence. My childhood neighbor was a varsity student athlete in the president of junior class and the most popular girl in school. Oh boy. One day in September in 95, a car crash took her life, and she had been driving home on the freeway when her car went across the meridian and collided. You know the story. It happens 30,000 times every year. A third vehicle was said to have struck her car moments before, causing her to lose control. The police... Was she really in control then? The police put out a call for information, apparently without success. My neighbor's passing was shocking and heartbreaking, but at the time, it felt like a basically unavoidable tragedy, like so many others. In our small city in Michigan, like everywhere in America, driving is the price of first-class citizenship. We never stopped to ask whether a different bargain was possible, since her passing, approximately 1 million more Americans have been killed in car crashes. 1 million. That's since 95, which is a bit of time, but it's still quite a lot of death. In America, the freedom of movement comes with an asterisk, the obligation to drive. This truism has been echoed by the U.S. Supreme Court, which has pronounced car ownership a virtual necessity. The court's pronouncement is telling. Yes, in a sense, America is car-dependent by choice, but it is also car-dependent by law. As I detail in a forthcoming journal article, over the course of several generations, lawmakers rewrote the rules of American life to conform to the interests of big oil, auto barons, and the car-loving one-percenters of the Roaring Twenties. They gave legal force to a mindset. Let's call it automobile supremacy. Ugh, that is a scary thought, right? That the 1% of today are currently setting up legal paradigms that will then also affect us for generations and to come. Do you see why I have a revolutionary approach and why it just has to be torn down or just completely reworked? Like, there's no reforming this shit. Okay, they gave legal force to a mindset. Let's call it automobile supremacy. Just as law can give, set out white supremacy, and no one seems to, you know, seems everyone rolls with it. This kills 40,000 Americans a year. I said 30,000. It's more like 37,000. I keep forgetting it's more. And seriously injures more than 4 million more. 4 million a year. Including all those harmed by emissions and climate change, which aren't factored in. Let's add another 10 million to that, as far as asthma and whatnot. And the damage is even greater. And by the way, that asthma damage is disproportionate black neighborhoods and Hispanic or minorities. Okay, and so it's racist too. Anyway, as a teenager growing up in the shadow of Detroit, I had no reason to feel this was unjust, much less encouraged by law, but it is both. It's no secret that American public policy throughout the 20th century endorsed the car. For instance, so in that case, it does feel like the government is picking the winners and the losers, but why did they pick that winner? Oh yeah, so they built a massive network of urban and interstate highways at the public expense. Less well understood is how the legal framework governing American life enforces this dependency. To begin with, mundane road regulations embed automobile supremacy into federal, state, and local law. But inequities in traffic regulation are only the beginning. Land use law, criminal law, torts insurance, vehicle safety regs, even the tax code, all these sources of law provide rewards to cooperate with what has become the dominant transport mode and punishment for those that deny it. Let's begin. So, I'm oppressed. I'm oppressed, guys. Let's begin at the state and local levels. A key player in the story of automobile supremacy, it's a good phrase, is single-family only zoning, a shadow segregation regime, redlining documentary here, that is now justifiably on the defensive for outlawing duplexes and apartments in huge swaths of the country. Though these and other land use regs, laws that separate residential and commercial areas, or require needlessly large yards, zoning rules scatter Americans across distances and highway-like roads that are impractical or dangerous to traverse on foot. Resulting densities are also too low to sustain high-frequency public transit. High-frequency meaning every 15 minutes. That would be the ask for a usable system of buses and whatnot. Further entrenching automobile supremacy are laws that require landowners who build housing and office space to build housing for cars as well. You know, when I was in Cleveland, and there are other cities like this, it's like every third building is a building for cars. My downtown area also has a substantial number of parking garages. How much of it could be housing? How much of it could be park? In large part because parking quotas, parking lots cover more than a third of the land area in some U.S. cities. Houston is estimated to have 30 parking spaces for every resident. Let's say that again, 30 spaces for each person who lives in Houston. Because it's also including all the people who, I guess, live in suburbs of Houston. As the UCLA urban planning professor Donald Stroop has written, this mismatch flows from legal mandates rather than market demand. Every employee who brings a car to the office essentially doubles the amount of space he takes up at work. And in urban areas, this employer may be required by law to build him a $50,000 garage parking space. For those who didn't get the message from the sprawling landscape that zoning has created, the tax code sharpened it by lavishing rewards on those who drive and punishing those who don't. On its own terms, the mortgage interest tax deduction is neutral as to the type of home finance. But given the twin constraints of zoning and mortgage lending, this deduction primarily subsidizes large houses in car-centric areas. Those who walk or bike or work receive no commuter tax benefit, while those who drive receive a tax-deductible parking. Another provision of the tax code gives car buyers a tax rebate up to 7,500 when their new vehicles are electric or hybrid. Buyers of brand new Audis, BMWs, Jaguars can claim a full 7,500 from the American taxpayer. Environmentally, these vehicles offer an improvement over gas-powered ones, but not public or active transit. Even so, 85 to 90% of toxic vehicle emissions in traffic come from tire wear and other non-tailpipe sources. While electric and hybrid cars still produce these things, they also still contribute to traffic and can kill and maim the people they hit. Why are we taxing bus riders to pay rich people to buy McMansions and luxury electric SUVs? Further questions to add on to last week's episode, where I talked about the high proportion of pedestrians killed by SUVs. Drivers are subject to traffic regulations and vehicles to crashworthiness tests, but even in these areas, governments have prioritized motorist convenience over other goals, including the lives of people who aren't driving. The National Transportation Safety Board has determined that speed is a top risk factor, unsafe at any speed, as Ralph Nader put it. It calls for setting speed limits that 85% of drivers will obey. This method makes little provision for whether there's a park or senior center on a street, or for people walking or biking. So you have many suburban roads where the speed limit is 40 when it's could otherwise be very walkable, but then unsafe. As a matter of law, repeat the phrase, the operating speed method is exceptional. It enables those who violate the law, speeding motorists, to rewrite it. Speed limits ratchet higher until no more than 15% of motorists violate them. Perverse incentives are obvious. Imagine a rule saying that once 15% of Americans acquired an illegal type of machine gun, that weapon would automatically become legal. Other legislation amplifies the harm from this method. In California, for example, cities are sometimes obligated by law to raise speed limits against their will, and local governments are barred from lowering them, even for safety reasons. This occurs against a backdrop of radical under-enforcement of the speed limit nationally, and the widespread banning of proven but unpopular life-saving technologies, such as automated speed cameras. Well, that's its own debate, personally. Fourth Amendment issues. Just as telling as what activities the law regulates is those whose interests it seeks to protect. Dozens of our peer nations require carmakers to mitigate harm to pedestrians caused by their products. U.S. design regs, however, require only measures that enhance the safety of car occupants. Just as SUVs are becoming taller, heavier, and more prevalent, and pedestrian fatalities are surging, U.S. regulators have not required car makers to embrace this more comprehensive design standard. Instead, they've launched campaigns basically blaming pedestrians for their own deaths. Bring out the guillotines. But this itself is like, I'm not going to call it like an American attitude, but it's the attitudes that we have, that we make things safer for the privileged as things go forward, and thus more dangerous, and the more privilege that one group has, the more dangerous it is for other groups. One group's gain is another's loss. And that is something that is not natural. As is the point of this article, it is not a natural process. It is, unless you think laws are a natural process, and who decides and how, what kind of laws are written, that's all natural. Now, you could say it's inevitable based on the social relations we have. Yes, that's Marxism. It's a Marxist conclusion. It's the kind of conclusion that one has before you then start thinking about how do we overturn everything, or how do we fundamentally change everything? What kind of incremental change would then have to happen? What do we push for that can be done this year? And what kind of goals should we have 5 years and 10 years from now? States don't require drivers to carry enough insurance to fully compensate people they hit. Yes. The most common amount of required bodily injury, and by the way, in some states, and I think it's been proposed to change this, it's actually not like, oh, that's right, it's just a moving violation when you hit somebody. You're not charged with manslaughter if you kill them. You're not charged with aggravated assault or negligent assault. So let's put the negligent prefix on all of those things. It's negligent manslaughter. But you're not charged with that when you kill somebody with a car. You're charged with a moving violation. You get a ticket. Is that justice, even in a punishment-based system? No, it is not. The most common amount required bodily injury coverage is $25,000. In some states, it's zero. A number of states also employ no-fault systems associated with increased fatality risks. This all lowers the upfront cost of driving, but those who lack the protection of a vehicle suffer disproportionately. Tort law is supposed to allow victims to recover from harms caused by others. If the standard of liability that applies to car crashes, ordinary negligence, establishes low expectations of how safe a driver must be. Courts have held that a higher standard, strict liability, which forces more careful risk-taking. And by the way, the reason why the cost has to stay low to drive, and the liability and the expectations of safety are so low, is because there's a whole industry on the line. An industry that was saved by the Obama administration. You know, Detroit was bailed out so they could keep making SUVs. Rather, so the workers there could keep making SUVs, specifically, to use a working class side of things. But they could easily be making buses, too. But that could have been written in the bailout package, by the way. That Detroit needs to start making trams, buses, and other transit things. But no, we're still in the legal regime that almost it wasn't really up to the federal government. That Chrysler and other companies would be allowed, in fact encouraged, to just make SUVs. Because as far as a federal bureaucrat's concerned, lower traffic fatalities occur when it's all SUVs. So, Fiat Chrysler, as mentioned before in the previous episode, they don't even make sedans anymore. Amazing. In a similar spirit, criminal law has carved out a lesser category uniquely for vehicular manslaughter. Deep down, so the fact that it's a separate charge, manslaughter with a vehicle rather than just saying it's negligent manslaughter. Like if you accidentally kill someone with a gun, you know, that's a felony, but if you accidentally kill someone with a car, not a big deal. You know, so what? Deep down, all of us who drive are afraid of accidentally killing someone and going to jail. This lesser charge was originally envisioned to persuade juries to convict reckless drivers. Yet this accommodation reflects a pattern. Even when a motorist kills someone and is found to have been violating the law while doing so, for example, he ran a red light, criminal charges are rarely brought, and judges go light. So often do police officers in New York fail to enforce these rules and illegally park their own vehicles on sidewalks and in bike lanes that specific Twitter accounts are dedicated to each type of misbehavior. Given New York's lax enforcement record, the Freakonomics podcast described running over pedestrians as the perfect crime. Since the dawn of the automobile, governments have been slow to address its downsides. We have gloated too much over the usefulness of the motor car, says the New York World in 1913 editorial. We put it into reckless hands. We make no effective laws against its misuse. In the years since, American government at all levels crossed the line. Instead of merely accommodating some people's desire to drive, our laws essentially forced driving on all of us. Basically, the 1% culture trickled down. The 1% decided that, well, they like driving, so they will fashion laws that make it easy for them to drive, which then, of course, makes it easier for everyone else to drive, forces them to drive, and thus buy cars. And then consigning an underclass status to those who do not or cannot own a car. All of these laws can be reversed directly by legislative bodies responsible for passing them in the first place. However, a growing body of academic research suggests that even when most people favor less restrictive zoning, local officials will side with wealthy homeowners who favor the status quo. In these cases, state legislators can be called upon to help. Reformers have succeeded in doing so in Oregon and have shown promise in California. Far less attention has been paid, however, at the federal level. Recently, several Democratic candidates for president have released federal plans to prod states and cities to relax their zoning. Congress could condition a small share. So this is the Atlantic's kind of style. So they state the problem. I have radical/revolutionary responses and conclusions from it based on my own experience and other books I've read and other evidence. Atlantic writers will then go into a screed of all of the reformist bullcrap that we could do to mitigate the harm, you know, harm reduction. And I'm not against harm reduction, but there's a difference between harm reduction in this sense of in the cases like this, all right, on the economy and cars, like we're not dealing with individual trauma and things that take time to resolve. And certainly when it comes to, say, redesigning our cities, that's also a generational process. But I'm saying go big or go home. And when you talk about just harm reduction in the context of our goals, even in the long term, or there's no vision of, say, eliminating the problem, not on board. Congress could condition a small share, say 5% of federal funds, on the adoption by states of housing production goals or a Vision Zero design standard. Conditional Vision Zero is Vision Zero. That's the New York City program of lowering pedestrian deaths. This is also how Congress has goaded states to raising the drinking age, are already in use for numerous transportation programs. Litigation for dangerous street design is another promising way to hold public entities accountable. So far, plaintiffs have mostly sought money damages, but they can also seek design changes through injunctive relief, including by class action. Finally, reformers could seek recognition for the freedom to walk. Federal Americans with Disabilities Act and state and local counterparts, as well as the case law, recognizes a constitutional right to movement, suggests such a right. Americans customarily describe motor vehicle crashes as accidents, but the harms that come to so many of our loved ones are the predictable output of a broken system of law. No struggle for justice in America has been successful without changing the law. That goes for even revolutionary struggle. You're just creating a new regime of laws. The struggle against automobile supremacy is no different. Now, I mentioned briefly that if you can't buy a car, you're assigned to underclass status. No one wants to be there. So, even if you don't have the income, then you take out a loan, a car loan, and let's say if a bank doesn't give it to you because you're poor, you're at risk, let's say because you're a minority, then you go to loan sharks and then you're exploited because you have to have a car. It's not a choice. Freedom? Huh, what is that? So, there are a record number of Americans with these things. So here's the story. Washington Post, voice of the oligarchy, as I call them. A record 7 million Americans are 3 months behind on their car payments, a red flag for the economy. Capitalist economy, I will mention. A socialist economy that favors public transit, let's say, because it's mass transit, because the masses matter, or what matter, and not car industry's profits. They care about whether or not people are going to default on their car loans, just as there's also student debt. There's also car debt. As it's been mentioned, well, it hasn't been mentioned much, half of Americans have net like zero assets because their debt cancels out whatever money in the bank they have. So they basically have zero wealth, half of Americans. Let's do this by Heather Long, published in February. So I was also going to kind of have a topic about, like, there is a coming, the next economic crash is coming. It's starting to crop up a little more, like, say, in the local paper. There's a story about, like, they framed it in terms of, like, the Trump trade war and tariffs are making business leaders nervous, or just saying it's unpredictable. But that's their parlance for, like, we don't know what's going to happen. It's probably going to be bad. Because usually, like, when it's going to be good, that's when it's because it's predictable and we predict that it's going to be good. Like, we know it's going to be good. Everything's lined up. All the ducks in a row, all the contracts, all the laws have been passed to facilitate the wealth transfer from the working class to us. Everything's coming over rainbow for the 1%. But I'm going to talk in the context of everyone else. So let's see. A record 7 million Americans are 90 days or more behind on their auto loan payments. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York reported Tuesday, even more than during the wake of the financial crisis. Even though the financial crisis, no, it wasn't dependent on auto loan debt default, but, you know, it was debt default. Economists warn that this is a red flag. Despite the strong economy, okay, and low unemployment rate, okay, many Americans are struggling to pay their bills. So it's not really a strong economy, is it? It's strong for Wall Street. for the financial sector, they can all get the guillotine in a video game. The substantial and growing number of distressed borrowers suggests that not all Americans have benefited from the strong labor market, says the economist at the New York Fed. Oh, man, they can just eat grass. A car loan is typically the first payment people make because a vehicle is critical to getting to work. I wonder why that is. And someone can live in a car as if all else fails. What great writing. So empathetic to the plights of people. When car loan delinquencies rise, it is usually a sign of significant duress among low-income and working-class Americans. So detached, this writing style. Repo men are doing better than ever. That's a link to another article. Your car loan is your number one priority in terms of payments, said Michael Tejano, a senior director at Fitch Ratings. If you don't have a car, you can't get back and forth to work in a lot of areas of the country. A car is usually a higher priority payment than a home mortgage or rent. As homelessness goes on the rise, people who are 3 months or more behind on their car payments often lose their vehicle, making it even more difficult to get to work, the doctor's office, or other critical places. The New York Fed said that there were over a million more troubled borrowers at the end of 2018 than there were in 2010, when the unemployment hit 10% and the auto loan dependency rate peaked. So it's like, as more people have gotten jobs, more people have had to get cars to get to those jobs, because the jobs haven't been created in urban areas. They've been created in the service sector in suburban areas, so you have to drive there. So everyone needs a car, and then everyone has to take car loans out, and it's good money for those that sector, but then what happens when everyone can't pay? And yeah, because those jobs aren't putting wealth back in people's pockets, they don't pay enough. Today, unemployment is 4%, okay, and job openings are an all-time high because they're throwaway jobs. They're bullcrap jobs. Yet a significant number of people cannot pay their car loan. Most of the people who are behind on their bills have low credit scores. And by the way, the job openings are high, and I think if you ask employers, and there's plenty of other articles and coverage of this, that no one's qualified for anything. Like, we have all these openings, and no one's qualified. Like, we can't find the right person. What does that say? What does that say about, like, our society? That, like, there's all this quote-unquote work to be done, but nobody is quote-unquote qualified to do it. Now, I think this stems, and it's just a hazard a guess here, that the growth sectors are service-related. But the high-income job growth has been in the tech sector. So the last 20 years, and going back to the 90s, the trend and the demand of parents have been that the education system prepare their children to be in the tech sector. But anyway, people were, and that means the masses, even people in the urban areas, were trained to be in the tech sector, which does not require good social skills. Rather, it was the tech and the STEM fields were prioritized over social skills, social science, social civics, and another type of a full, well-rounded education was deprioritized. And I'm not just being dismissive of any kind of tech skills programming. I have friends and whatever. But I'm just saying, it was the trend to train everyone that way, because that's where the jobs were, and parents want their kids to have the best income possible. But that means you have an entire economy that's service-oriented, majority service, and everyone just seemed to be unprepared to actually deal with other people, thus leading to enormous amounts of social and emotional strain, because no one is even trained to do emotional labor. There are people who are, but it's short supply sometimes. I certainly feel unprepared, but it's something that I've devoted my quote-unquote career to. Most of the people who are behind on their bills have a low credit score, oh whoa, and are under the age of 30, suggesting young people are having a difficult time paying for their cars and their student loans at the same time. Right, because, so it spends a few paragraphs saying how, like, you know, car is the first priority, But by law, student loan debt comes first. Like, you go bankrupt with student loan, you can't default on it. Like, your wages are garnished. So, like, you don't even have the money to pay your car payment because the student loan by law actually does come first. Auto loans surged in the past several years as car sales skyrocketed, hitting a high in 2016, 17.5 million vehicles. Overall, many borrowers have strong credit scores and repay their loans on time. Oh, wow, what a great... But defaults have been high among subprime borrowers with credit scores under 620 on an 850-point scale. The share of auto loan borrowers who were 3 months behind on their payments peaked around 5% in 2010, so like high of the recession, I guess, call it that. The share is slightly lower now, 4.5%, because the total number of borrowers have risen so much in the past several years. This is where just using the percentage doesn't really tell you everything, because there's kind of the gross number matters. Still, economists are concerned because the number of people impacted is far greater now, and the rate has been climbing steadily since 2016, even as more people found employment. Because it's bullcrap employment. Experts warn Americans to be careful where they get their auto loans. Oh, yes. The experts warn that is, hey, it's hard out there, but you just got to be careful. It's an individual problem. Traditional banks and credit unions have much smaller default rates than auto finance companies, such as buy here, pay here places, and some car lots. Fewer than 1% of auto loans issued by credit unions are 90 days or more late. So credit unions have better rates, of course, compared with the 6.5 issued by auto finance companies. The number one piece of advice I have is to not get your financing from a car dealership, says a law professor at University of Utah, former special advisor to the Consumer Protection Bureau. Shop separately for the vehicle and the financing. Go to a credit union or community bank to get a low-cost loan. Well, I certainly can back more community banking. Rates can vary substantially depending on a borrower's credit score and where they obtain a loan. Prime borrower with a credit score, and it goes into that stuff. Let's see. The amount of money people borrow to buy a car is also, you know, smaller than mortgages. While defaults on auto loans are a red flag, they are unlikely to take down the entire financial system. Total auto loan market is over $1 trillion. Oh, just over. A trillion, far smaller than the $9 trillion in the home mortgage market. The amount of money people borrow to buy a car is also much smaller, typically under $35,000 versus a home loan, which is at times several hundred thousand dollars. Holy moly. And that itself is debt slavery, because you'll be paying that off your whole life. Let's see, the last article is... tangentially related is this mashup piece in the culture section, how being sad, depressed, and anxious online became trending. So a general question about how having mental problems, or want to avoid being ableist here. So this is getting in the weeds, and hopefully I won't get sidetracked here. I only have 15 minutes left. Okay. So the intersection of digital spaces, online culture, and just how terrible everything is. And going back full circle to the little piece I was saying about looking at the ground instead of forward. We need to be able to envision our goals and how to meet them. Because if things become hopeless and cynical, and thus depressed and anxious, if you accept things as they are, or only get a feedback loop of information or suggestions on how to change things, which, you know, on their own and intuitively seem ineffectual, because they are. That's where a radical revolutionary approach comes in. It allows you to have a framework, or rather it gives a framework of setting goals where you can actually envision where you want to be instead of looking at the ground. Because when you're moving, where you're looking is where you're going. If you're looking at the ground, you face plant over and over and over again. Social media personas, starting the article, built on an illusion of happy, perfect lives, are so tired. In 2019, it's all about being sad online. So being trendy, emotional distress on social. So I'm with grain of salt. The framing of this article, I take it as tongue in cheek, or rather, I'm taking it as like there's problems with this article, but I'm just gonna go through it. Trending emotional distress on social media is part of many must-follow accounts across platforms, whether by retweeting the depressing relatability of So Sad Today Twitter accounts, or commenting the obligatory same on a My Therapist Says Instagram post, as recently immortalized by a Tim Robinson sketch in Think You Should Leave. Even if you do post pictures where you look cute and happy, it must be accompanied by a self-deprecating caption. The era of being sad online is defined by a sense of reverse FOMO, a tacit agreement to redefine being cool on the internet through JOMO, which is the joy of missing out. Then file it under social anxiety. And by the way, people are missing out because they're overworking and not living their best lives. They're not able. They're not free. Then file it under social anxiety. So basically, to me, all of these problems can also be filed under the authoritarianism that pervades our lives. The tyranny of car supremacy, white supremacy, whatever kind of supremacy. It is a ruling class supremacy. And at the end of the day, at least it's, you know, let's see. It's possible, though, that constantly posting about our sadness or anxiety can at times be just as performative as the positive vibes and self-care culture that is starting to feel passé. While posting about our upsetting vibes may feel more real or authentic, for some it might just be a new way to fit in online. There's also been, and thus creates another set of feedback loops, there's also been a flood of social media campaigns encouraging people to speak openly about their mental health, which is very positive to me. The social media hive mind has rushed to express their own genuine emotional distress with the intention of helping to normalize, destigmatize, and relate to those struggles. In our haste, though, we might have forgotten the fundamental and vital distinction between sad feelings and the terms used to diagnose mental disorders like anxiety and depression. So, it is saying it is good that we are now able to express a full spectrum of feelings, and not keep them bottled up and those become toxic, and then they can only be expressed by, say, drugging ourselves with alcohol or something else. But really, the problem is just that there's a lack of language in discussing these emotions since they've been so repressed over the generations. People label their sadness as depression and their nervousness as anxiety when the problems that they're facing often don't reflect these psychological problems. If healthy people are convinced that they're depressed, they ultimately identify with the glamorized social media posts, aggravating the phenomenon even more. This is speaking Jian Jennifer, a graduate student from the International School in Lebanon and co-author of a 2017 study that tracked these posts about mental health. Social media has increasingly blurred the line between what is authentic and what is performance, even within ourselves, a split self. Very bad. While posting about our upsetting vibes, many feel more real. For some, it might just be a new way to fit in. Don't get us wrong. By all numerical accounts, there's never been more people reporting mental health issues than right now, especially with young demographics that dominate social media. The anxiety of not having a future. We need to build one. A recent Pew Research study found that 7 in 10 teens think anxiety and depression are the biggest problems their peers face. Medical journal JAMA analyzed the CDC's data showing a dramatic increase in suicide rates among Americans 15 to 24-year-olds. Beyond young people, the CDC also cites the oft-repeated statistic that 1 in 5 Americans experience mental illness in a given year. What a sick society we live in. I don't know how anyone can defend it. Even these parts that are like, oh good, it's still part of it, in a way. The American Psychiatric Association, itself it has own problems, reported an increase in anxiety and depression among boomers in recent years as well. We are more anxious and depressed than ever before, or at least talking about it more freely. But the trendiness of sad online culture may lead to wrongful self-diagnosis an inadvertent trivialization of serious illnesses. So to me, this is kind of like a very small problem, but this article is a way of discussing just how out there it's all becoming, which is good because the more we kind of recognize it. But I think that the concern here is that it will become self-reinforcing, that if it's popular, or rather it seems like you're fitting in by also being anxious and depressed. More and more teenagers are convinced that depression, anxiety, anorexia, and bipolarity are cool or can make you special. Another co-author in the social media study and professor of sciences at the University of Balamain in Lebanon. The study focused on a specific type of Tumblr and Instagram posts which blatantly glorifies mental health issues through specific hashtags by portraying them as appealing on social media. More people identify with these misrepresentations, which can then lead to all sorts of harm. So it's romanticizing it to some extent. I have a theory about this.